Hello, everyone out there in computer land. My name is Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to share Time Magazine with you. I need to remind you that you are listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on AirsLA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. We'll be reading from the September 8th issue of Time, that's 2025, and much of the issue is devoted to AI. So let's start with the page written by the editor, titled The People Behind AI, which stands for Artificial Intelligence. Today, we publish the third edition of the Time 100 AI, our annual look at the most influential people in artificial intelligence. We launched this list in 2023 in the wake of OpenAI's release of ChatGPT, the moment many became aware of AI's potential to compete with and exceed the capabilities of humans. Our aim was to show how the direction AI travels will be determined not by machines, but by people. Innovators, advocates, artists, and everyone with a stake in the future of this technology. Our aspiration for Time Magazine is to be your trusted guide through this transformation. This year's list further confirms our focus on people. One of the dominant AI storylines of 2025 has been the competition over people. Investors have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into startups, reflecting the perceived value of founders. And leaders of big tech firms like Meta's Mark Zuckerberg have reportedly offered nine-figure deals to attract prize technologists. Those hires, accompanied by frenzied rumors, have turned the once obscure competition over AI researchers into something that better resembles professional sports free agency. The stakes for beating the competition are so high that leading researchers are courted like NBA all-stars. Two of Zuckerberg's noteworthy hires, Alexander Wang and Nat Friedman, join him on the 2025 Time 100 AI. Since we began the Time 100 AI, spending on AI-related technologies has accelerated, becoming a key driver of the global economy. Whether this is for better or for worse, it is too soon to tell. But investment in computer processing equipment is growing at nearly four times the rate of GDP. Computer scientist and 2025 honoree Stuart Russell estimates that the current planned expenditure could be 25 times the amount spent on the Manhattan Project, even adjusting for inflation. This is a historic deployment of capital, meaning money, and the decisions on how to spend it are being made by many of the individuals who join the Time 100 AI community this year, including SoftVac CEO Masayoshi Son, CEO Sam Altman, XAI founder Elon Musk, White House AI czar David Sachs, and the EU's Henna Verkkunen. Also in this issue, we show how these individuals' decisions are transforming not just the technology industry, but also how we live and potentially how wars will be won. Justin Worland and photographer Elliot Ross traveled to Atlanta to show how the physical spaces like data centers, which make AI possible, are stressing our energy grids. And Billy Parigio reports from Paris on the geopolitical calculations and risks that accompany the competition for achieving artificial general intelligence. The AI industry is changing rapidly. Only 16 Time 100 AI honorees appeared previously on the list, which was overseen by Ayesha Javed. As AI's entry into our lives has quickened, so has the volume increased of voices warning about its developments. Those voices are recognized, too, in this year's list, including Pope Leo XIV, researcher Yoshua Bengio, and French minister Clara Chapez. It also includes artists venturing into the frontiers of what is possible and what happens when humans and AI work together, like Refik Anadol, who created this issue's cover image, and actor Natasha Lyonne. I understand the spark that AI invokes in people. Life is scary, Lyonne told Time. The fact of the matter is that it's upon us. Best we drive in, I think. We are diving in at Time also. In addition to the Time 100 AI community, we're growing a team of reporters dedicated to covering the people and ideas powering AI. Part of their work can be found in a new newsletter authored by Parigio and Andrew Chow called In the Loop. We're also experimenting with how AI can improve our distribution of Time's coverage. Our partnerships with AI companies like OpenAI have helped make Time Magazine one of the most cited sources of information on platforms like ChatGPT. And this summer, in partnership with Scale AI, we launched our first AI audio briefings. Soon, we look forward to debuting the Time AI Agent, which will create the most interactive and personalized reading experience ever for Time's trusted reporting. And whether we will get to any of those Time 100 in this recording session, I'm not quite sure, but I'm going to head through the magazine in a sequential manner. And what we don't get to this time, expect it in the next recording. We'll start with the brief. Headline, Putin's Brush Off by Simon Schuster. The Kremlin appears in no rush to negotiate peace with Ukraine, despite Trump's efforts. It was around midnight in Moscow when President Vladimir Putin took a call from the White House. President Donald Trump had just spent several hours on August 18th in meetings with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky and seven other leaders from Europe who had come along in a frantic effort to shore up United States support for the Ukrainian position. Now, Trump was telling Putin about what he believed needed to be the next step. The leaders of the two warring sides, Trump said, should meet in person and try to make progress toward peace. But Putin seemed to have other plans. After the call, the Kremlin issued a mealy-mouthed statement suggesting that it might be worth exploring the possibility of raising the level of representatives in future peace talks. Whatever that means, it seemed a long way from accepting Trump's suggestion that Putin himself sit down with Zelensky. On other points, too, the Russians reverted to their familiar methods of wartime diplomacy, making threats, issuing demands, and playing for time. The threats from Moscow became especially aggressive when it came to the central questions of the closely watched talks at the White House. If a peace agreement were reached, how could it be secured? Who would guarantee that peace? And by what means? On these points, Trump seemed to move closer to the position of his European allies. We'll help them out with that, he said during his press conference with Zelensky at the start of the marathon talks. We will give them very good protection, very, very good security, he said. The protections would be NATO-like, echoing the promises of several European members of the NATO alliance, who have expressed a willingness to secure any future peace deal in Ukraine using their own troops. Those statements began to approach what President Zelensky has long been seeking, a clear commitment from the United States and its allies that they would step in to defend Ukraine from any future Russian invasion. Without such a commitment from his allies, Zelensky has argued, Ukraine cannot agree to any peace deal because it would be based on little more than Putin's word and Trump's promise to help out with the future defense of Ukraine. That seemed like a tentative but tangible step on the path to real security guarantees. It was enough to provoke a furious response from Moscow. In another statement, the Russian Foreign Ministry said that any scenario involving NATO troops coming to Ukraine's defense in the future would risk an uncontrolled escalation of the conflict with an unpredictable consequence. Any firm attempt to secure the peace, in other words, would only deepen the war and make it worse. That warning did not leave Trump with any clear options for advancing the peace process beyond the latest stage of Russia's obstructionism. In his concluding statement, after at least 5 hours of talks with the visiting leaders from Europe, Trump said he began the arrangements for a meeting between the leaders of Russia and Ukraine, but he did not say that Putin had agreed to participate. On the crucial question of security guarantees for Ukraine, Trump also sounded a lot more circumspect as the long day of negotiations wound down. We discussed security guarantees for Ukraine, which guarantees would be provided by the various European countries with a coordination with the United States of America, was what Trump said. This sounded a lot less convincing than Trump's suggestion earlier in the day that Ukraine would receive a NATO-like commitment to its security. But given the pushback he got from the Kremlin, Trump did not have any room to promise much war. After his summit with Putin in Alaska on August 15th, he had already set aside his main source of leverage over the Russians, the threat of sanctions and tariffs that could weaken Putin's economy. We don't have to think about that right now, Trump remarked at the time. Secretary of State Marco Rubio later confirmed that the threat of sanctions against Russia was off the table for now. I don't think new sanctions on Russia are going to force them to accept ceasefire, Rubio said on NBC's Meet the Press on August 17th. But Trump may have no other means of bringing Russia's leaders to the negotiating table. Their intent to continue the war in Ukraine has come through loud and clear in their statements and, in one case, even their fashion choices. Arriving for the summit with Trump in Alaska, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had the letters USSR written across the front of his sweater. He later insisted on Russian state TV that there was nothing imperialistic about the message. But when asked about Putin's readiness to meet with Zelensky, the minister deflected. Any such summit, Lavrov said, would need to be organized step by step, gradually, starting with the expert level and going through all the necessary stages. Russia, in other words, is in absolutely no hurry to talk about peace. Unless Trump changes that dynamic, and reviving the threat of economic sanctions is his best option for doing that, the status quo seems unlikely to change any time soon. All right, moving on now to an article from Texas. This is in the bulletin section on page 7. And the article is written by Solsire Berga. Headline, ICE Lone Star Lockup Mega Detention Facility opens. A detention center poised to become the largest of its kind in the United States opened on a military base in El Paso, Texas on August 17th. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said it was an effort to decompress ICE detention facilities in other regions. More than $1 billion will be invested in the Fort Bliss Center to expand its current 1,000-bed capacity up to 5,000 capacity. Dubbed Lone Star Lockup, its opening is part of the Trump administration's effort to use U.S. military bases and personnel to enforce immigration rules. Infrastructure boom. A Washington Post report found that ICE plans to add more than 41,000 detention beds in 2025, nearly doubling its capacity from the start of the year to deliver on the American people's mandate for mass deportations. Assistant Homeland Security Secretary Tricia McLaughlin said in a statement to Time magazine, funding comes from the one big, beautiful bill, which included the largest detention and deportation investment in U.S. history, per the American Immigration Council. Passed in July, the bill allocated $45 billion for immigration detention, a 265% increase to the ICE detention budget. Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem is exploring purchasing a fleet of airplanes for deportations rather than chartering flights, NBC News reported on August 20th. Checkered history. Fort Bliss has served as a Japanese internment camp during World War II and, more recently, as an emergency shelter for thousands of unaccompanied migrant children during the Obama and Biden administrations. In 2021, two federal employees filed a whistleblower complaint alleging mismanagement of childcare and public health and safety concerns. Rights concerns. Immigrants' rights advocates cited desert temperatures and an isolation designed to break people down, strip away hope, and pressure them into giving up their cases, wrote the ACLU's Hattie Kesama. The mega facility opened despite the El Paso County Commission unanimously passing a resolution in August opposing it. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas countered the criticism, calling the center humane and safe. Okay, let's move on to page 8, the news section of the brief. Good question. Headline, why are so many women leaving the workforce? This was written by Alana Samuels. 212,000. That's how many women ages 20 and over have left the United States workforce since January, according to the most recent job numbers released August 1st by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. By contrast, 44,000 men of the same age have entered the workforce since January. The numbers are especially stark for women with children. From January to June, the labor force participation rate of women ages 25 to 44 living with a child under the age of 5 fell nearly 3 percentage points, from 69.7% down to 66.9%, says Misty Lee Hegenis, an associate professor of economics and public affairs at the University of Kansas. It's a big reversal. The participation of those women had soared in 2022 and 2023 and 2024, peaking in January of 2025, as flexible work policies helped women join the workforce and generate much needed income for their families. This year, workers have seen flexibility revoked on a larger scale. President Donald Trump ordered federal employees back to the office 5 days a week in January. And Amazon, JP Morgan, and AT&T also returned to a five-day-a-week policies in 2025. Overall, full-time in-office requirements among Fortune 500 companies jumped to 24% in the second quarter of 2025, up from only 13% at the end of 2024, according to the Flex Index, which tracks remote work policies. It is not a coincidence that women's participation in the workforce is falling as flexibility disappears, says Julie Voigtman, Senior Director of Job Quality for the National Women's Law Center. Women capitalized on remote work and flexibility during the pandemic and stopped exiting the labor force, research shows. Now, many are not able to do so. Women still take on the lion's share of caregiving responsibilities, and they are more likely than men to be navigating how to meet those caregiving responsibilities while holding down a full-time job. They are also more likely than men to feel that they have to leave the workforce when their balancing act becomes unimaginable. The disappearance of flexibility is not the only reason women are leaving the workforce in 2025. Some of the decline in participation comes because federal dollars for childcare have declined significantly in 2025. That money helped many centers stay open and charge lower tuitions than they otherwise would have. The federal funding helped some providers keep their costs down. Now, childcare expenses are rising again. You have a population of working women who are finding it increasingly difficult to make the math work, Voigtman says. As women leave the workforce, the Trump administration is exploring ways to encourage women to slow the country's decline in birth rate. But Hedgenis says the return to office policies may be making some women put off having children. What they are doing right now with the return to work policies and their leading by example is the exact opposite of what you would expect to be doing from a policy perspective if you really care about increasing birth rates, Hedgenis said. There are bigger reasons to be concerned about women leaving the workforce. Without two incomes, many families struggle to afford the basics like housing, food, and transportation. They have less money to spend, which means less money circulating in the economy. Economic growth has slowed in the first half of the year. In the long term, slowing growth worsens people's standards of living. For many women, this is more than an economic problem. It's a depressing reminder that the brief period of time when work from home reigned, when balancing family and work was actually sometimes possible, is now over. Big picture, women's labor force participation has stalled in the United States in recent decades, peaking in the early 2000s, even as it rose in many countries in Europe. But then, during the pandemic, rates started rising again, as women could handle caregiving responsibilities while working from home. When I hear about these companies making everyone go back to the office, the most normal situation is it's being ordered by some old white male person with what I call care privilege, says Hedgenis, which is that they have someone who cooks their meals, irons their clothes, or picks their kids up from daycare. All right, let's move on now to a page in the health section of the brief. Headline: Five Ways to Make Small Talk When You Have Social Anxiety. This was written by Angela Haupt. When you have social anxiety, walking into a room full of people can make you feel like every eyeball in the place is boring directly into your soul, and that nothing you say will possibly be smart or funny or coherent enough. That can trigger an array of physical, cognitive, and emotional symptoms. For some people, it might mean a racing heart and dizziness and feeling flushed, says Kirsten Hall Baldwin, a licensed clinical professional counselor in Chicago. Others might be in these thought spirals or feel like their mind is going blank or even freezing. Hall Baldwin coaches her anxious clients to create a coping plan, a proactive list of strategies and techniques that can help temper their unease. Here, she and other experts share five tips on how to carry on a conversation when you have social anxiety. Number one, practice in low-stakes settings. Before showing up at a networking event or your 10-year high school reunion, try making conversation with baristas, waiters, neighbors, or coworkers. These short interactions can be a low-pressure way to build self-esteem. Smaller, manageable social interactions don't carry as much emotional weight, Hall Baldwin says. These aren't necessarily a goal of having a deeply meaningful conversation, so it's just trying to participate without feeling overwhelming pressure. Over time, you'll gain a sense of comfort and confidence as you venture into larger social settings. Tip number two, script some go-to phrases. Come up with and rehearse two or three simple conversation starters you can use when your brain starts sputtering. That way, you'll have something in your back pocket to continue the conversation, says Carolyn Finkel, chief clinical officer with the virtual mental health platform, Charlie Health. You can keep it going without having to freeze and leave to go to the bathroom. One of her favorites. That's really interesting. Tell me more about that. If you love traveling, ask people where they've gone on any recent vacations. Or if you're a foodie, find out if your conversation partner has tried any great new restaurants nearby. Tip number three, learn the echo technique. And I believe this has been around for some time called active listening, but let's see how they cover it here in Time Magazine. Number three, use the echo technique. One of the best habits for someone with social anxiety is paraphrasing what the other person said and then encouraging them to elaborate. For example, if they mention they're struggling at work, repeat back their words with a question in your voice. Struggling? They'll most likely launch into an explanation of what's giving them a hard time at work. People want to feel heard, Hal Baldwin says. A lot of the time, just showing attention, awareness, and attentiveness can encourage the other person to keep on sharing. And that takes some of the pressure off of you to feel like you have to come up with original responses. Tip number four, find an anchor. Holding a cold drink, touching an object like a fidget toy, or simply pressing your feet into the floor can give your nervous system something to anchor to when you're feeling anxious. Research suggests it can bounce you back to the present moment and curb your feelings of anxiety. It helps signal to your brain, I'm safe, Fentel says. When she does public speaking engagements, she puts a worry stone into her pocket, which is a smooth, oval-shaped gem with a thumbprint-like indentation. Every time I get nervous, I just have to touch it, she says. Doing so creates a physical sensation of security that propels her back to the finish line. And the final tip, number five, have an exit strategy. The good news about social events is that they all eventually end, and your departure can arrive as soon as you like. You might feel better if you let your friends know from the start that you have an early morning and will be able to stay only until a certain specific time, or make it clear that you have an afternoon appointment that will keep brunch from turning into dinner. It's also a good idea to brainstorm a few ways to politely wrap up conversations, Hal Baldwin says. For example, it was really nice talking to you. I'm now going to go check in with Jane over there. Doing so can help reduce anxiety about feeling trapped in any conversation, she says. All right, I think our last article for today will come from the View section. It comes from the world of politics, and it's titled Poor Vote, Swing Vote by William J. Barber II and Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. Barber is president of Repairers of the Breach and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Wilson Hartgrove is author of Revolution of Values, Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good. All right, here's the article, Poor Vote, Swing Vote. On the one hand, this is the worst of times. Power is concentrated in the hands of people who pray at the opening of Congress and then pray, P-R-E-Y, on the people they swore an oath to serve. But a close look at voter demographics suggests that a small percentage of poor voters who understand what they are losing have the potential to upend American politics. Over the past four decades, as inequality has grown exponentially for all Americans, the number of poor and low-income white people, 66 million in 2018, has swelled higher than any other demographic. This is one reason low-income, majority white communities became susceptible to the populist appeal of the MAGA movement. If white people are hurting, the divide and conquer myth suggests it must be because black people or immigrants are taking from them. By leaning into an aggressive investment in extreme ICE raids, President Donald Trump's administration has bet the farm on this myth. But the reality of American politics is that despite these appeals, most poor people don't vote against their own interests. While Trump improved in 2024 among low-income voters who cast a ballot in the election, new data from Lake Research Associates makes clear that the real change was in the number of poor and low-income people who decided not to vote in the race between Trump and Kamala Harris. More than 19 million people who helped elect President Joe Biden in 2020 didn't even show up in 2024. Nearly a third said that their number one reason for not voting was that they didn't feel as if the Democrats' message spoke to their specific economic situation. Poor people are not driving the extremism in American politics, nor are they the true basis for Trump, whose major policy achievement has been to cut government programs that serve everyday people so he can give tax breaks to corporations and very wealthy Americans. Poor and low-income Americans are, in fact, the largest swing vote in the country. We need a movement to engage poor people who haven't voted because they have never imagined that the system could work for them. As they begin to feel the impact of the cuts from Trump's big budget bill, poor and low-income people must organize to demand candidates who will represent them, Movements that bring poor people together across lines of race and region can build on America's history of moral fusion movements to strengthen democracy for all of us. In our book titled White Poverty, we wrote about how the 2018 midterm saw a roughly 10% increase in voter participation over the previous midterms, a larger four-year increase than the one that led to Barack Obama's record-breaking turnout in 2008. Many factors contributed to this surge in participation, but a raw number increase in low-income voters made a significant contribution to the blue wave that returned control of the U.S. House to Democrats in 2018 and put a check on Trump's use of the White House to reward elite interests and undermine policies that lift poor people in 2020. A movement can change how candidates talk and what agenda they promise to pursue when elected. Democrats need a new wave of leadership that not only articulates a vision for how government can serve everyday people, but also demonstrates that they are committed to use executive action, change courts, and use power to win policies that lift from the bottom so everyone can rise. If a moral fusion movement led by poor and low-income people can rise up in America today, we have the numbers to change the political conversation. This is why we have launched Moral Mondays across the South in districts that will be hurt first and worst by cuts to health care, and organized people who will be directly affected to speak directly to their representatives with clergy and moral leaders by their sides. A movement led by these people, linking arms across racial lines and joining hands with progressive allies, could decide not only the presidential elections, but also many congressional and statewide races. Poor and low-income people make up a third of the United States electorate, more than 40% of the electorate in the swing states that will decide the 2026 midterms. It is time for poor people of every race to reject the myths that have been used to divide us and come together to demand an economy that works for all of us. Such a movement isn't only good news for the poor, it is the best hope for American democracy. And we will conclude our reading of Time magazine at that point. We will continue next week, and that's when we will be able to get into the Time 100 AI Most Influential People. All righty. I need to remind you again that you have been listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. And items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Again, I'm Nancy Porter, and it has been my pleasure to share Time magazine with you.